I'd like to call the meeting for December 17th, 2019, Tompkins County Legislature to order. Will you join me in the Pledge of Allegiance? Roll call of members.
Anna Callis.
Here.
Dan Klein.
Here.
Ann Corman.
Present.
Mike Lane.
Here.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne.
Present.
Dave McKenna.
Here.
Glenn Morey.
Here.
Mike Sigler.
Here.
Shauna Black.
Here.
Amanda Champion.
Here.
Deborah Dawson. Henry Granison.
Here.
Rich John.
Here.
Martha Robertson.
Here.
14 members present.
Thank you. I'm going to be asking for an executive session. We'll have a number of topics, and we'll put them all together at the end of the evening to discuss personnel issues regarding a specific individual, to receive legal advice on that personnel issue, labor negotiations, and real estate.
Wow.
So that will be at the end of the evening. Do we have any blue cards? Are there any members of the public who'd like to speak to the legislature? Okay, wow. That's a first, I think, isn't it? All right.
Christmas.
We do have a municipal official. Duxton, join us. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here. From the City of Ithaca. Hi.
Hello. So at last council meeting, we did, I think someone has mentioned it before, but we did approve our bus to use Seneca Street as a bus station in front of Starbucks. I had to relocate a fire hydrant that either has already happened or is happening right now. We also had the initial non-binding developer agreement with Ficino for the Green Street Garage, so that is moving forward. The viability of the conference center is still up in the air. Planning and Economic Development met, and I think most of you know this, that the ADU discussion was tabled till next month because of the county's 239 review, calling for a couple of things that I appreciated but my colleagues may not have, including allowing multiple dwelling units, multiple primary structures on a lot. And
Mr. Duxton, could you speak a little louder or
sure.
slower or something?
So the ADU discussion at Planning and Economic Development was tabled till next month because of the county's 239 review comments. That included the county's determination that the allowing multiple primary structures on a lot should be maintained, and a contiguous green space requirement should not be included in the legislation. Two things that I personally agree with, but are controversial with some of my colleagues. A bit of exciting news. The city has come to an agreement with NYSEG on purchasing the streetlights in the city. I don't know exactly when that will happen and when our LED conversion will happen, but the money has already been allocated by council years ago, and so that is exciting for our constituents who have long complained about poor streetlight maintenance. The other thing I'll note is odd even parking is in effect. So tonight, if you're watching, park your car on the odd side of the street. Thank you.
Thank you, Duxton. Any questions or comments? All right, I think this is what happens when we have food before a meal, before a meeting. Yes, everybody's. I just want to thank you for agreeing with the 239 review from the county. And just as a recap, it's required by state law on municipal regulations or projects that may have intermunicipal effects. And our county department of planning and sustainability has 30 days to comment. Once receiving the formal ordinance or the exact project description, we have 30 days to comment. And so at the December 11th meeting, it was actually 11 days earlier than the target time. So we understand that there was Not enough time for everybody to get together about it, but and I know that staff and I believe Seth Murtaugh are also going to be speaking about it, and I look forward to people coming together on a good set of regulations. So I don't know if there's any other comment on that. Anything else for Duxton? Rich.
I just wanted to say thank you for so consistently coming and updating us. This is really helpful.
Yeah, thank you for sending representatives to council as well. I don't know if George and I will be assigned next year, so I'll just say Happy New Year to everybody right now.
All right. Thank you so much, Doc. We really enjoyed having you and George all year long. Thank you. All right, legislators. Anna.
Just one announcement. I wanted to remind everybody that tomorrow at 4 p.m., we have our Environmental Management Council doing a presentation at the Tompkins County Public Library, Borg Warner Room, and that is on the book of a county evaluation report on the forest lands, county forest lands. I encourage everybody to read it. I thought it was very thorough. But yes, it is 100 pages. So the first 10 pages are an executive summary. So at the least, I do encourage you to read the first 10 pages. And hopefully I will see you all tomorrow at 4 p.m. for a presentation on this report.
Thanks, Anna. Amanda, then Annie.
Thank you. I put on everyone's desk a copy of the water bulletin. This is from the Community Science Institute, which we do give a little bit of money to. This is their latest update on the past 2 years of HABs monitoring on our lake, and it's chock full of great information, charts, graphs, everything about nutrients and phosphorus and all the things that they've been studying. It's a really growing problem. I know I've brought it up before. I know other people are aware of it, but this is a really good way to learn a little bit more. So if you have some time, please take a few minutes and read this. If you really want to get involved next summer, you can become a HABs Harrier and volunteer to walk around the lake and take samples and monitor and send the information back to the lab. I actually might do it next year. I think it would be really fun. Anyway, so please do read this and keep up to date with what's going on with HABs.
Thanks. Annie Corman?
Thank you. I wanted, since this is the last legislative meeting of the year, I just wanted to say that I'm very grateful for working in a county with legislators, with staff, department heads, and other staff that really care about people in the community. And so I just wanted to say that. And then on another note, speaking about caring for people, just a reminder to folks, I know for myself, I'm very fortunate. I have a roof over my head. I have transportation. I have food. And just a reminder that it really means a lot, you know, if you could check on your neighbors or friends or family members, because not everybody is so fortunate. So sometimes just stopping by or bringing a little food means a big deal, or just a call to check on people. So thank you.
Thanks, Anne. I've got Mike Lane, Henry, and then Dan.
Maybe reading some of the headlines the last few days about the commemoration of the Battle of the Bulge, World War II. 75 years ago, in December, this was after D-Day, and after the Allied armies were marching toward Germany, the German army rallied in some of the worst weather that had been seen in a winter for a long time in Europe. And it was weather that kept the Allied airplanes out of the sky. And they punched through the Allied lines with their tanks and other things. And you've probably heard stories about Bastogne and other well-known defensive positions that were held. They called it a bulge because if you drew a line on the map where the lines came together. Where the Germans punched through, you could draw a line out, and it looked like a bulge in that line. I don't know whether they had a Sharpie back then, but that's how they did it. And the reason it comes home to me, and I want to mention, is the fact that my dad was in that. My dad had been working in a defense plant in Buffalo, making airplanes, the Curtis Wright plane factory up there, had been part of a special team that was top secret trying to develop a new, I think it was a fighter. But eventually there was need for more men, and at age 30, with a wife and child, he was drafted and went to Fort Dix and then through basic training and then into to London and Wales, and then they sent him over because of the Battle of the Bulge. They needed troops on the ground. And it was terrible. The men in his unit, most of whom were young, 18, 19-year-olds, went directly into the fight. Their equipment, their warm clothing, their boots and everything went a different direction. My dad never talked about how awful things were over there. We see some of the documentaries now that has been an eye-opener for me. And someone recently pointed me to a book that had been recently written by the son of one of the leaders of that company. And the name of the book is Unlikely Heroes. And it tells their complete story as it went through. And my dad isn't particularly mentioned in the text. He's mentioned as was one of the people that were there. But looking at my dad's medical records from his doctors at VA, which we got after he passed away, I found that he had frozen his feet, what's called trench foot back then, on January 15th, 1945. And in this book, it tells about how they were pinned down in an open field by machine gun fire and other things. And he was there for 15 hours. And he called it a foxhole, but a foxhole then was maybe a flat place in the snow was about all they could have. So don't want to go on too long, but I did want to honor the fact that so many people were involved in that battle on both sides. And there were a lot of people that were killed, and we don't want to forget about them. And so when you read something about the Battle of the Bulge, it was a serious, serious cold battle. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike. That's an important story. I appreciate that, and I'll always think about that whenever I hear about the Battle of the Bulge again.
Thank you.
There were many, many people who came back from all of our wars who and still do, who aren't able to talk about the experience, but I think especially in the earlier days, nobody even thought that that was a problem, and that there was anything to process, and at least today we recognize that. So thank you very much for sharing that with us. Henry, and then Dan. Dan.
Thanks. I just wanted to mention some TCAT news. There was a press release about it. I just thought I'd mention it briefly. That, as you know, TCAT's been looking for a potential site for a new facility, and the board of TCAT has decided to pursue a site at the airport. So this is just the beginning of a long process now. The next step is that you have to undergo federal environmental review, and that's expected to take up to 9 months. And then we go from there. We're not even allowed to apply for federal funding until that review is complete. So there's a long road ahead still. TCAT's setting up a meeting of the partners of the county, the city, and Cornell, tentatively scheduled for early February. We're going to see if we can make that happen, to make sure that everybody knows everything that we know about this potential move at this point, and also about lots of other things, TCAT. So I just wanted to let you know there's more coming about that over the next year, two, three.
All right. Thank you, Dan. Anybody else? All right. Thank you very much. First, I want to say, I mentioned food before. The dinner that we have here is in honor of four retirees that we are celebrating and thanking tonight. And anybody in the audience who hasn't had any, or you want to go back for seconds, please help yourself. There's plenty. But we wanted to I just want to thank again the folks who were who've been so important to our county. Marsha Lynch, Public Information Officer, Julia Maddock, Director of the Workforce Development Board, Pat Buchel from Tompkins County Probation, and Lee Shurtleff, Department of Emergency Response. Four of our long-serving department heads who have been leaders in their fields, and we are deeply, deeply grateful for your service. We hope we can find people to succeed you well. I think we will, but you all leave big shoes to fill, and we're deeply grateful for everything you've done. Enjoy your retirements. Things quick and then a few remarks. First, I would like to ask in a few moments to ask Shauna Black to move the resolution H up on the agenda. So we'll do, not yet, but we'll do that on the public health, mental health merger, bring that up forward on the agenda. And I wanted to just mention, I think everybody here has asked me, so what about the airport? What about the airport? We don't know yet. We're waiting. If anybody gets a text from my call while we're sitting here, raise your hand. But we expect to have a ribbon cutting in the next, I'll say week. So it should be a great event. I just want to take a couple of moments. I had the occasion last week to answer a reporter's questions on the last 10 years. You know, we're entering a new decade. We're entering the 20s, folks. I mean, you haven't stopped to process that yet. It was almost 10 years ago when I took up the chair seat on the podium as your chair for the first time. I've been chair 6 of the last 10 years. Of course, that was the podium in the building 2 doors down, where the room was about maybe a quarter of this space, the whole room. Only a few of us were here at the time. Dave, Leslin, Mike Lane, Kathy, Michelle, Jim Blizzard, Marsha. So I just thought I'd run through a few things as a look back on the last 10 years. Just about a month after I first became chair, I got actually kind of a scary letter from Judge Robert Mulvey. It said, Mike remembers, that we needed to move out of the courthouse, like, by February. So we had, at the time, the legislature, we had the district attorney, we had the county clerk, but we also had the office for the aging in the basement of the main courthouse. And so after years of delay, I mean, years of trying to put the issue off, we did start a cascade of decisions and moves that have led us to much of the physical facility arrangements that we have now. So sometime after we moved into this room, Judge Mulvey came in for a visit. Remember? He looked really jealous. I mean, thanks to Holt Architects, we've done a really nice job on this room. And frankly, I think he was a little sorry that he wasn't going to be in here anymore. It was also a move that was established that the Office for the Aging should be downtown. We moved out of the main courthouse and took over the Carpet Bazaar on Martin Luther King Jr. Street. And it was a big debate. Should they move up to space at the health department on Brown Road, which, by the way, had recently moved to Brown Road? It was made clear we wanted to have county services available and accessible centered downtown. And it was important that day reporting in that cascade of moves move from the old library to new space, to renovated space at the Human Services Building. And that really helped to establish it as a permanent county program. It wasn't something that every year we said, should we have day reporting anymore? Have we evaluated it enough? Trust me, that's how we spent the first 10 years of day reporting. But as of that move, we really made a statement. So to look at, you know, what we've accomplished in the last 10 years, that was one big thing, and it was part of the maturation of all of our ATI programs and other investments that we've made since then as well. As a result, we've drastically reduced our jail population without jeopardizing public safety. 10 years ago, we were averaging 81 inmates a day. 81. Now we're about 50. That's remarkable. In 2009, we spent more than $250,000 on boarding inmates out. This year, we boarded inmates in. And we are about to have a third county court, which will further accelerate the judicial process for people, make our system fairer for everybody, and help move people through. In the last 10 years, we accomplished redistricting with an independent commission chaired by Hank DeLay, one of only two counties in the state that used an independent commission. I remember Greg Potter being so excited about the new technology, the whole idea of, you know, he could change the parameters, change the lines of the districts with the mouse, you know, with stroke of the mouse. It was new technology. It was really enabled us to do an excellent job on redistricting. Right around 2010, we established the Health Insurance Consortium. And that was a path-breaking initiative, a collaborative process that has now grown into cover 43 municipalities. Just this past year, from 2018 to 2019, it grew by 18%. It now covers 6,100, almost 6,200 lives, has a $53 million budget. And over these 10 years, the average premium increase has been 6.44% versus 9.78% for comparable plans for municipalities. So just two-thirds of the average because of the power of collaborative effort. And the Tompkins County Council of Governments came also out of that consortium. Consortium was its first project, but TCOG really got established as a result of the consortium, turning previously litigious relationships into collaborations. I mean, we had lawsuits going back and forth. The town sued us, we sued the city sued the town. We really ended that. 10 years ago, we were just learning what fracking was. And fracking was an issue that really mobilized TCOG with a gas drilling task force. What, no?
No, something else.
But this county really led the movement, led the opposition to fracking. Legislators, staff, and community members, the public, working together, schlepping to Albany for rallies, going to New York City for press conferences, Binghamton for hearings by the DEC, Syracuse for press conferences. We got signatures of more than 850 local elected officials from every county in the state opposing fracking. And the things that happened here were a big part of Governor Cuomo's decision at the end of 2014 to not allow fracking in New York State. We followed that with, okay, you're not going to have gas. We need something else. So this county stepped up our efforts on sustainability, fighting climate change, with innovative initiatives that have set new standards and goals for even greener investments to come. Just a couple of examples. You know, we installed solar panels on 7 county buildings. We refurbished the hydro plant in Waterloo so that almost all of our electricity, county government's electricity, comes from that hydro plant. We have been working for years on the gas moratorium in Lansing, working with the Public Service Commission and with NYSEG to try to establish a non-pipe alternative way of providing the energy needed for growth and economic development. On the issue of housing, we have considerably increased the supply of housing. We have done pretty well. David West has a report that's coming out, will be coming to the committee next month. But we haven't quite met our targets, and we especially have not met targets for affordable housing at lower and middle income levels. So that's something we need to continue to work on. But the Community Housing Development Fund was started 10 years ago, partnership with the city and the county. Since then, the housing fund has supported 654 affordable units, affordable for 49 years, a $4.7 million commitment, leveraging another $177 million in outside money. We have, led by the articulation of nodal development by our planning department, we've seen that housing development primarily in the established nodes of the county, the villages and the city and the urbanized area. As David will show in his report, our goal was 66% of housing to be developed in the established nodes. In the last 10 years, we accomplished 63% in the established nodes. That's a complete flip from the previous 50 years. So it is a concerted effort documenting that planning makes a difference, that articulating the vision about why denser development matters has really been successful. Internally, we've had two climate surveys of county staff. Institutionalizing this method of really surveying our employees, getting deep into their relationships with each other, relationships with the public. We've had robust follow-up, and we continually work on that to improve our service to customers and experience for our staff. We, during the last 10 years, had an in-depth study of the civil service system with the help of Cornell students and lobbied New York State for greater flexibility so that we could have a more flexible outreach, and we hoped to be able to increase diversity of our workforce. Unfortunately, New York State decided they weren't interested in flexibility, so we keep working on that. And, of course, recent accomplishments with the airport expansion and renovation, the third county court, and the move from the Department of Transportation from the waterfront. There are some other landmarks for the past 10 years. So looking ahead, where should our focus be for the next 10 years? At the start of 2030, what will you look back on? Obviously, county office space is going to be different. We're about to embark on another cascade of moves to get us completely out of the main courthouse and prepare the downtown campus for at least the next 20 years, maybe 50 years. For housing, I hope we continue to work hard to accelerate the pace of housing development, to reduce our carbon footprint, and to bring housing costs within folks' ability to pay, so especially working on housing at moderate prices. We have a special obligation in terms of housing for those with the greatest challenges to self-sufficiency. I think it's safe to say one of the problems that's been increasing is homelessness in this county. There are a lot of reasons for it, and I hope we will find new ways very, very shortly to make a permanent difference for as many of these folks as we can. In terms of sustainability, it's fair to say we've just begun to fight. Our new capital plan to get to net zero in county operations by 2035 is ready. We're ready to get to work on that. I hope by 2030 we will look back and say that renewable heating and cooling has become the standard for housing and commercial buildings. I'm hoping that in terms of agriculture, we'll really begin a stronger focus on adaptation and carbon capture. And I think we can't talk about sustainability without talking about transportation. 10 years from now, TCAT will be in a new facility. 10 years. Less than 10 years. And we will have even more comprehensive services countywide as a result. And it's important that we keep fighting for opportunities for all. Economic and social justice require an even greater focus on diversity and inclusion throughout our workforce. I look forward to new progress with our Chief Diversity Officer and our rejuvenated Office of Human Rights. I hope we will continue to strengthen our local economy by supporting new business development, a downtown conference center, and workforce initiatives to prepare Tompkins County residents for 21st century jobs. And all of that so that we can continue to build a community that's welcoming and supportive to all. This has been a productive, exciting decade. I thank everyone in county government and our community partners and the public, now and over the years in the past, for their dedication to creating a better community and planet. Here's looking forward to the next 10 years.
Here, here.
Thank you very much. County Administrator, Jason Molina.
It's a hard act to follow, Martha. Thank you very much. Over the past month, we have gone through an interview process in interviewing candidates for the director of probation position as Pat Bichelle is looking to retire at the end of next month. I've shared with you that recommendation. At this point in time, I'd ask if there's any questions to break to executive session. If not, I'd request we move forward to consider confirmation.
Would anybody like an executive session? None. Rich, Chair of Public Safety, would you like to make a motion?
I would be very proud to make the motion to nominate Dan Cornell for the new Director of Probation position.
Yeah. Henry? Would you like to second that? All right. Seconded by Henry. Did you already say Dan's name?
I didn't, but I'd like to recommend Dan Cornell.
All right.
Yeah, I'm out of order there. I was.
No wonder you hesitated, but.
That can't say.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. No.
I blew that. Go ahead, Jason.
No, Dan. Dan has been a probation officer since 1995. He started in Delaware County and came to us in 1999, and for the better part of 20 years has served our community, and has risen to the rank of deputy director as of last year. He's been with us a good time. He served our community well, and with your confirmation, look forward to working with him in the future.
With that said, I'd like to renew my motion.
Great. Thank you. And Henry News is second. Mike.
Jason, could you just briefly say what you did to...
Absolutely.
To find a candidate?
Sure. So the probation director position is one of the few department heads that is a competitive civil service position that requires a civil service test to be taken and passed. That test was given earlier this year. There were three candidates on that list that were internal. Two, we had asked all three if they were interested in the position. Two of the candidates came forward to interview for the position. Both are excellent candidates, and we have been served well by both of them, and we're thankful that we have them both in the department. After that process, the interview process involved two members of the legislature, Legislator Rich John and Legislator Henry Grandison, Kit Kephart, our Commissioner of DSS, Lance Salisbury, the supervising attorney for the assigned counsel. Deb Dietrich from OAR joined us, as well as Lisa Holmes, in the interview process. Interviewed both candidates, and again, both of them were excellent candidates. Also, following each interview, the staff of each department had a meet and greet and a series of questions that were facilitated by the Deputy Commissioner of HR to receive feedback, and then they provided anonymous feedback to the panel to review as well. After those deliberations, made the recommendation of Dan to this body.
Thank you.
Are we ready to vote? And then, Dan, I'm put you on the spot. I'm going to ask you to say a few words.
Dan is here with his wife and his daughter as well.
All right. All in favor of confirming the appointment of Dan Cornell for probation director? In favor? Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you.
embarrassed. I really did not expect to get choked up. Thank you. I just wanted to thank all of you. I'm really humbled and grateful, appreciative to all of you for putting your faith in me. I know I have big shoes to fill. Pat's been a great mentor. She's given me a lot of exposure. I know a lot of you through the meetings here, and we have a great department, thanks to Pat, and I intend to do everything in my power to stay true to her values and my values and the values of the county and provide quality services to everyone in the courts, the victims, and the people that we serve who need some assistance to, you know, live healthier and more productive lives. So thank you all very much.
Thank you so much, Dan.
I have nothing else to report on other than we submitted the shared service plan, or we will be submitting the shared service plan by the end of the month. Also, just a time frame, Pat's last day is January 30th, so over the next 45 days, Dan and Pat will work closely together during that transition, and his appointment will be effective January 31st.
Wonderful. Thanks very much, Jason.
Thank you.
And Jonathan Wood is in Albany. Have you heard from him, Mr.?
Yes. Jonathan was up in front of the appellate court today, got caught up in a little bit of a snowstorm, so he is stranded in Albany. He can't be with us today, but we'll be available by phone if we need him.
All right. And he did say he would check in later. Thank you all. Any questions for Jason? Yeah, Amanda.
I was just going to ask you to give us an update on the other department head searches.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. This week we had the first series of interviews for the Director of Human Rights. We will have another interview on Friday. And then we will have personal interviews, finalist interviews for the Workforce Development Board at the beginning of the new year. So we had phone interviews for those last week. And that's the only searches we have at this point in time. And then next year we'll get into the HR commissioner, public information officer, chief equity diversity officer, and then probably into February the director of emergency response.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions for Jason? Annie.
Did you say workforce development interviews I have down for beginning of January?
They were yesterday. Yes, beginning of January, Annie.
Oh, that's funny. Okay.
Yes. I'm sorry.
I'll get you back.
Yeah, I know you will. Yeah, yes, they're for the beginning of January after the new year. Yep.
Okay, great.
All right, Julia, do you need anything?
No.
Happy holidays. All right, thank you.
Also, the intent with that is to have someone on board for about a month or two to overlap with Julia, because she's scheduled to retire at the end of March.
Maybe that's what she was waiting for.
Probably.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Jason. Drew Brayman, a deputy finance director. Rick is on vacation.
Yes, Rick is out of the country, so good evening all. On packet page 5 is your exciting October sales tax report. I won't spend a lot of time with it, but I will comment that Rick had reported for September there was a slight decrease. That has reversed to continue the trend that we've seen previously through the year. So for October, we actually saw just over 4% increase year over year. And then year to date, we've actually brought into the county share $31.8 million. That compares to roughly $30.5 million for last year. So that's all I have.
Thank you very much, Drew. Any questions? Mike Lane.
Remind me when they take the AIM funding out of our sales tax. Is it this month?
I believe it is scheduled for December.
A portion of it is now, and I think a portion of it is in June.
Okay. In June?
Okay.
Thank you.
Dan.
Yes, that reminds me, and I I feel like we kind of went through this, but if I'm reporting to the towns where we're at on their sales tax, is that number reduced because that percentage is taken, the aim is taken off first?
This would be, there is no additional reduction in what you have here. So this is not December's numbers. So December's numbers, when we receive them, we'll already have that number taken out of it.
So wait till December.
Yes, yeah, or January.
But the question is, will the AIM money come off the top and the towns and villages get 3% or 1% of what's left?
Or do they get theirs first and then the counties?
Generally not. It would be taken out of the top and then distributed to the counties.
So they're helping to pay for their own AIM aid, right? That's your question, Dan?
Yes, thank you. Yes.
Okay, anything else for Drew? All right, come on. We don't want to put him on the spot some more, no? Okay, thank you so much, Drew. Appreciate it. All right, before we do the consent agenda, I would ask you to go to resolution F. No, not F. Shauna, with H. Resolution H, packet page 35.
Yeah, thank you, Martha. I would like to move resolution H. Doc ID 9026, a resolution authorizing the county administrator to implement a plan merging the departments of public health and mental health into one department, and that full operations as one merged department be effective no later than July 1st, 2021.
Seconded by Anna.
So I believe everyone has been part of at least most of our meetings and were in attendance for Jason's presentation. We've also been talking about this. We've had two different meetings in Health and Human Services Committee, and we've had a task force comprised of 7 members, 3 from the Community Services Mental Health Board, 3 from the Board of Health. We also have 3 members that are here tonight from the task force. So if there are any questions in regards to their findings, I'm sure that they're more than happy to answer those. The conclusion that they came to is that it would be a good idea for us to merge these two departments. I would also encourage legislators to have looked at their email, because there were letters that were sent on behalf of the Community Services Mental Health Board with recommendations, as well as the Board of Health that had some recommendations for us, and that were recommending. The Board of Health did, in fact, recommend us moving forward with the merger. And the Community Services Board, some of their members, they did not take a formal vote, and they had some recommendations in that letter that they would like to see moving forward.
Thank you, Sean. Any discussion? Deborah, then Mike.
I would just hope that as we move forward with this plan, we are going to be retaining the services of some sort of outside advisors to help us make this happen, so that the process looks as transparent and fair as it possibly can.
Do you want to talk about that?
I agree. I know we've had some preliminary discussions about process, and one of it is continuing to use the support that we have for the Kretzky group that has been assisting with strategic planning. After this vote, if the vote is to move forward with the implementation, I know Amy and I would get, as well as Lisa, would get with Frank's leadership team and talk about what resources may be needed. How do we approach that? A communication plan has to be developed that talks about how we communicate internally, externally, on a regular basis, consistent throughout the whole process, transparency, a lot of those initiatives. So I think after tonight, if it's to move forward, we'll have a series of almost pre-planning sessions. That would look
like. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Yep. My thought is that it's not about being fair. The issue is that that's a way to move things along efficiently, professionally, and while staff have lots of other work to do, so it's not, say...
Well, I think it's more the perception of fairness.
Yeah.
If somebody comes in from outside who's completely divorced from the organization as it goes forward. I think the general perception is that it's a fairer process. That's all.
Okay. Mike Sigler.
Hi. I've been thinking about this a lot, actually, and I got, like some of you, a call from Dick Booth about this. Dick Booth, former legislator. And he brought up, you know, some things that I had considered before and then phrased them in a way that I looked at this issue and actually forced me to kind of call Jason. I just wanted people to know that I had thought about what Dick was saying, so I didn't want him to think that I hadn't considered what he was saying, because it made a lot of sense to me. And that's, you know, the public health department deals with big issues, right? If somebody gets measles, we have a measles outbreak, that's what they deal. Or if we have a HAB, they deal with that. Or, you know, restaurants, they go and check all the different restaurants, make sure that they're okay. So, like, bigger public, you know, health issues. Whereas mental health is very individual. And the reason that really struck a chord with me was when, you know, my daughter was diagnosed with autism. It was a very individualized approach. It wasn't about the greater scheme of autism in the country. It was about literally one person and how do we kind of navigate to a different place with that one person. So it did. It had me really thinking about the difference between the two. And it did force me to call Jason and say, you know, how are we going to balance those approaches? So I kind of wanted to ask that question more of a public forum of how are we going to balance those two approaches? Between those two, they're not competing, but they are certainly different. So I didn't know who actually could answer that.
Well, aside from answering, being forced to call Jason.
Well, forced is strong, but, you know.
Yeah. So Jason or Frank, would you like to address that? Frank Rupa,
Partly what we talked about is, you know, a lot of the mental health services, most of them are individually focused, and a portion of public health services are public health, general health focused. There are quite a few programs in public health that are individually focused as well. MOMS, WIC program, additional other programs that are serving a certain portion of the population. And there's overlap in those clients as well, or there's overlap in the families of those clients. So while the general statement is that public health does have the broader general health picture in its view, it also serves individual clients, you know, just as mental health does. So it's not both are having opposite clients or opposite focuses. There is overlap in those, and there are areas where individuals can be impacted by general health matters, or, you know, epidemics, pandemics, those types of things, and mental health services are going to be a part of supporting a community as they go through some of those initiatives as well. But the question is not an unreasonable one, and there are individually served clients in a variety of programs in the public health department. I don't know if Frank has more to add to that. But please.
Good evening. I think Jason covered that pretty well. The one thing that I would add, particular to the mental health side of things, there are strengths at both places. And I think, Mike, you hit on it. Public health, generally, while we do direct services, and quite frankly, most of what we do there is still direct service oriented, our thinking is broader. And we're trying to look at things from a preventative perspective, essentially getting upstream. And in the mental health and substance use world, quite frankly, we've fallen behind because we have been so focused on treating the individual that comes in front of us that there hasn't been a broader conversation about how do we get upstream on that? How do we talk about prevention? How do we put services and programs in place so that we're not waiting until somebody has the acute need that they need to come in and necessarily get substance use disorder treatment or mental health treatment. Now, using the example of autism, that's a little bit different because it's not it's something that you have. But I do think that example is also pertinent in that we have gotten better at identifying those things earlier and figuring out how we put structures in place around families that have children that have autism or other developmental disabilities. And that is that is beyond just the direct service provision. It's looking at the totality of the family and what are their overall needs. I think I've heard the example used with someone that's had children in our early intervention program, and they were going, that's challenging, right? You're scared. You don't know what this means for your child, what their life is going to look like. You have needs then as well as a parent and a family member, and how great would it be if we were looking at this from a perspective of, yes, we have the child that we need to address their needs, but now we also know their family has needs as well that's beyond what we do in early intervention, and perhaps there are ways in the full scope of service that we as a county provide that we can have a stronger impact on that family as a whole. So that would be my response.
Thanks so much, Frank. Any other discussion, questions? Amanda.
I'll just bring up what I asked at the presentation and just encourage that as you begin planning and looking at how this is going to work, that you set measurable goals that you know, we can figure out if it's actually working. Like, there need to be ways to in 1 year and 18 months and 2 years to say, like, does this really make sense? And are people actually being helped better because we're doing this than not? So however you say that in legal professional terms, that's what I want you to do.
You captured. I think you're talking about performance metrics to be able to determine outcomes, and are we achieving those outcomes?
That's exactly. Yes. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Henry?
Yes, I know during the task force, you did not look at the cost of programs. And I was wondering why didn't you look at that? Because we don't live in a revenue neutral world, and so why did you choose a revenue neutral task force perspective?
I don't think the task force views it as their responsibility to try to. And I don't know that it's that possible to try to analyze the exact cost structure of each option. Revenue options could be different for each option, the task force didn't view their responsibility to get into a detailed financial analysis of each outcome. What they did was look at the management structure of each, outcomes for each, service delivery of each, and to a certain extent, a deep-rooted financial analysis would have been a difficult outcome. It would have been a difficult thing to do if at all attainable, just due to the different possibilities of revenue recovery that could take place. It wasn't within the scope of the task force to do a financial analysis.
Well, is the 18-month period going to be financial analysis?
I don't know. I think you'd have to ask you, what do you mean by a financial analysis compared to what? It would be my question. And what does that compare? What type of financial analysis are you looking to do? Is it going to be a financial analysis from year to year to year under a merged model and how it could be recreated in a separated model? What's the basis of the analysis and what are you comparing it to? Because in this, with this type of services and these types of service deliveries, outcomes have to play a way in that discussion, which is hard to balance those outcomes with cost. We can talk about benchmarking. I think this gets back to the performance measurement piece. We can talk about benchmarking as to the services we provide. How is that benchmarked to other communities and the general average in the state or general averages in the nation if they exist? Unfortunately, it's not as easy to do a cost comparison in that way because outcomes have to play a very important piece to that. It's just not simply a straightforward black and white cost structure, red in the red or in the black. So I think there would have to be more discussion around what does it mean to do the cost analysis and what are we trying to look at when we do that? Is it a cost per service? Is it a cost per client? There's a little bit more to that that I think we'd have to dig into to understand what people want to look at and how does that serve the evaluation of the service in the best fashion.
If I could just comment that we didn't embark on this in order to save money.
Right.
You know, there was never a goal of this study at all. So from my point of view, it's not saving money or spending more money is not necessarily one of those metrics I'd be looking at. I want to look at outcomes for the public. So did you want to say anything more?
Well, I mean, there were two.
Henry, did you want to say anything more on that?
Not on that. I have another question.
Okay, go ahead.
About I talked to someone, and they talked about the privacy of mental health records. And they were saying how, you know, any other records, those are probably the most valued in terms of privacy. And I know we've talked about the sharing of records between the departments. And so they see that as sort of an inherent conflict of oversharing mental health records from people who are not in a position to really protect their records. And how would that work out under the new system?
This is not a question I can answer. So I'm going to have Frank answer this question about privacy. I'm sorry. I'm not even going to try. But.
Yeah, it's a question that we've had a lot of conversation about in the last few months. Is we just went live in the joint EHR with Public Health on October 1st. And the first thing I want to assure everyone here and the public is we are not inappropriately sharing any information, mental health or public health-wise. I would also point out that we often talk about the security of mental health records as being the most secure. At the health department, we handle HIV/AIDS data on a pretty regular basis, which rivals the level of privacy associated with mental health records. So we are not unpracticed in either department on how to handle protected health information. So I just want to assure everyone before I say anything else that we are protecting the privacy of the folks that seek service at either department. How the new system is working, the only information right now that is shared between the two departments is basic demographic information, your name, your address, and your medical record number. Also, Social Security number. That's probably the most protected piece that we share. And the reason that that's being shared is for patient lookup purposes. The idea is that we're working in the same electronic health record system, and if somebody is a client of mental health and they show up at public health, we want to be able to put their name in and know that they're going to have one record rather than two. And if you don't have a patient lookup capability, you wouldn't be able to do that. Beyond that, any information that is shared, there is no other information shared without consent of the client. The only other information that can be seen by a public health nurse, a public health nurse only, no administrative staff, and only if somebody seeks services from the health department and then signs a release that they are seeking those services and are aware of the information that is being shared is diagnosis, medications, allergies, and any labs that have been run. And the reason for that is in order to provide high-quality care, we need to know that information so we don't have any contraindications between the care that we're providing. So we want to make sure there's no conflicting medications that are being prescribed and that there is an awareness of any particular issues related to the care that we need to be aware of. Beyond that, right now, there is no plan for sharing any additional information. Now, we do expect in the future, as this evolves and we become more clear about the different types of services we provide with the two departments, with input from staff from both of the both departments, and we start talking about treatment teams across both departments, that we would potentially want to share additional information in order to be able to better meet the needs of that client. None of that information sharing would occur without direct specific consent from the client, meaning they would have to sign a particular consent saying that they agree to the sharing of the information between the two programs. We do that now. We do that within the mental health department. There are two separately licensed programs, our clinic and PROS. Right now, there are staff that are like, why can't I see information in PROS when I work in the clinic? Because that would help me better serve this person. We're not allowed to do that. And we put protections in place to make sure that that doesn't happen unless the client specifically signs a consent that allows us to do that. We do it in two ways. We do it technically through the system where we remove people's rights to see certain parts of the system, and we do it administratively through policy and training. We do significant amounts of training on privacy. We have annual reviews of those privacy rules that we follow. So we take significant steps to protect people's information unless they give us a specific consent to share that information for their treatment.
Come on, Jason, you could have covered that.
So under the new system, would the pros and the clinics be able to share information, or would they still have to sign a release?
They still have to sign a release.
And what's going to be different under the new system? What's going to be different under the current system versus the new system in terms of signing that release? Will there be any, will you ask the release of everyone, or will you just ask the release of people that you, I don't know.
Releases have to be singularly particular to the individual. So there isn't some kind of thing where we just say, okay, we're now going to share all this information between two programs because we think it's the way to do it. If we decide we want to share information between programs in order to improve a client's care, we would have to get specific individual consent from that individual to share that with another program, whether it be pros to the clinic or the clinic to a public health program like maternal and child health.
Okay. Did you cover your yep. questions? Annie, did you have your hand up?
One question about the finances. My understanding is part of the reason that it is difficult because there is sort of an infinite number of ways that you could implement a program, and therefore there's a very wide range of cost around any specific program or initiative. I mean, that's kind of how I understood it when we talked about it in committee. So that was my first question. The second half of that is, given that you intend to come back to HHS on a regular basis to give us a sense of cost, finances, recommendations of implementation, any of that kind of information in case it's a dramatic shift from our current budget, I would suspect.
Yes, yes and yes to both those questions. Also, I'd add that services could change and services could be enhanced, which may change cost structures and may change the cost per service, too. So a lot of those are factors to consider, and I think the regular updating and dialogue of planning and the implementation process is going to be critical from two reasons, from a communication perspective with the Community Services Board, with the Public Health Board, with HHS, from a transparency perspective with those two boards and HHS as well. So I think that's a given, and it has to be a part of the communication plan that there's regular updating about these things. I will also add that the chart of accounts may not change drastically because the chart of accounts is set by New York State. The chart of accounts, meaning whenever you look at the budget, those little codes on the left-hand side, so every department, every county sheriff's department in every county has the same chart of accounts. That's how accounting is measured by the comptroller's office for a variety of reasons. So to a certain extent, some of those accounts aren't going to change, and some of the accounting from the state's perspective isn't going to change. This is where we're going to get into cost analysis of services, where it's going to have more value than, this budget line is different this year than it was last year. So there's going to be probably new baselines set within the next year or two as to what this is going to look like moving forward, because services may be accounted for differently and costs may be accounted for differently. So we may have to go through a little bit of a learning curve to be able to compare years to years because those chart of accounts and those cost structures may change.
And I just wanted to note, I know people have brought up a main concern, and I think a lot of us have heard this from constituents about mental health being subsumed by public health. And I appreciated the discussion you had. One of the things that has circulated in some of the conversations that I've had is the idea that actually the opposite may be true, that combining them may stabilize because it'd be much harder to remove any piece of it once they are unified, where in other counties a lot of them have closed their doors on their mental health clinics and outsourced that. Does that resonate with what you uncovered in your discussions with the task force?
I know the task force, and I know Sean has had a lot of conversation with it, and the task force had a lot of conversation about the concerns of one department overshadowing another through this process, and there was a lot of emphasis over mental health services not, you know, ensuring that they get both departments and the services get equal representation through this process, and that doesn't happen, that one doesn't get overshadowed. And I think as the dialogue went on, I think what you said is right, is that this has, may have an opportunity to highlight mental health services a little bit more. A lot of the comments shared from the staff were viewing this merger as an opportunity to continue to combat the stigma associated with mental health services and bringing it more to the forefront. This community in general, and just in general, you know, coming from the outside, is much more accepting of human services and mental health services, so I think that's a welcome change. So I think it, you know, going into this, the task force had a lot of conversation to ensure that no services or department overshadowed the other, and that specifically, you know, this could assist in trying to minimize some of the stigmas related to mental health services.
Thank you.
Sean, I know you've had a lot of discussion about it. I don't know if there's anything to add or I missed anything with it.
No, I think that was probably what I would say. And I know Frank gave the example of the early intervention in the family that was struggling, and that was my family. I have two kids that went through early intervention, and my wife and I, there were times where we would stare at each other and say, what is wrong with our child? And it would have been really nice had the person helping us been able to say, you know what, we have a therapist that's working down the hallway. Why don't I walk you over there so that your family can have a discussion? And I know that, you know, right now it really hasn't been part of the conversation, but I do hope in the future that that's where we're going, because I think it will help many, many people in our community.
Ann Corman.
Thank you. Having worked in healthcare before, I worked with children and adults with developmental disabilities. I worked with the elderly, people that had mental health issues, addiction, HIV, and as far as someone mentioned the confidentiality, I mean, that was just something that you just did. I mean, I might be working with another provider helping this person get discharged, for instance, that has an addiction issue, but they didn't sign something, permission for me to talk about their HIV status, and you just didn't. And so that's just something people, you know, working in that, we just do that all the time. And when I first heard about this, I was very skeptical, just because I really want to make sure that nobody's getting consumed, no department's getting consumed, or I'm trying to think of a nice way to say it, but I'll just leave it like that. I want to make sure that each department is respected, and each aspect that people could need treatment or assistance with is respected. And speaking about that, I spoke with somebody recently from the health department who said it would be great if we could have more of our social services departments combined. And so I hear that was talked about years ago, and maybe we should bring that up, because in some places, I come from Albany, where you could go to one building and you could get services for the aging and Social Security and mental health and various things all in one building. So whenever we're cutting this up and someone's saying, oh, for this issue, you have to go to that building in another part of the city or downtown, and how do you park there, and who do I call? And it's just every time you make it a little bit harder, or there's another form to fill out, it just makes there's people that are going to drop the ball, or do they just literally can't do that. So any time we can do a soft handoff of somebody coming down the hall, or say, you know, or an integrated application, or anything we can make it easier, I think is and preventative services. So I like the way that we're headed, so I'm all for this right now.
All right. Anything else? Ready to vote on Resolution H. All in favor, please raise your hands. opposed? That passes with 3 opposed. That's 11-3. Thank you. I want to thank the entire task force. I want to thank Shauna and Amy and Jason and Autumn Edwards for in administration for a tremendous amount of work to go down every corner of this discussion over the last 18 months and spend hours and hours talking and researching and talking to staff and talking to the community, and kind of every question that was asked was followed up. So I thank everybody for their work and their commitment, and Frank especially, thank you for your leadership on this over the last few years to step into this role and to provide leadership going forward. We have a great deal of confidence in your ability to make this work. Thank you all. Okay. All right. So let us go back to – thank you, Sean. Let us go back to the agenda, where I first am going to ask, are there any resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda? All right. I'll go through the consent agenda. If you have anything to pull off, just sing out. Resolution A, approval of designation of successors, ID 9056. Resolution B, to amend a resolution number 2018-274 of December 4, 2018, determination and certification of county clerk's allowance, annual expenses for administering mortgage tax, ID 9013. Resolution C, adoption of apportionment of taxes for 2020, ID 8975. Resolution D, returned school taxes, ID 8974. Resolution E, returned village taxes, ID 8973. Resolution F, resolution to update. Oh, that's being pulled. Thought so. Okay. And Resolution G, 2019 budget transfer to cover additional wages and fringes in county administration for interim coverage of Human Resources Commissioner role, ID 9009. And appointments of quite a list. To the Public Information Advisory Board, Pat Pryor. To the Historical Commission, George Boyer, Raymond Wheaton, and Marcia Lynch. To the Library Board of Trustees, Jason Moore, Nina Schultz, and Sun Shelley Wong. To the Youth Services Board, Ian Schachner. To the Human Rights Commission, you've got 15 names here on your list. I won't read them all. They're all current members, and their terms are being extended. Board of Health, Shauna Black. Community Mental Health Services Board, Sheila McEnery, Jeanette Lynch, Maria Morag, and Larry Roberts. To the Mental Health Subcommittee, Jeanette Lynch, Larry Roberts, and Paula Winner. To the Developmental Disabilities Subcommittee, James Beaumont, Jeffrey Bowles, Elise Switzer. To the Strategic Tourism Planning Board, Kathleen Kurtz, Irene Martiel, Kelly Makosh, Stephen Stull, Barbara Romano, Brett Bossard, Gregory Mezzi, and Todd Parlato. Can I get a motion on the consent agenda? Moved by Leslie, seconded by Amanda. All in favor, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you so much. For the first committee report, back to Shauna Black, Health and Human Services.
Yes. Let's see here. We met at the beginning of the month and passed the resolution with a 3-1 vote, the resolution that we just passed a few minutes ago. Our next meeting, I will be reaching out to committee members. It should be January 3rd at 9 a.m., but I'm thinking some of us might still be on vacation. So we will have a conversation, and that will be posted a week in advance. That's my report.
Okay. Any questions for Sean? All right. Thank you very much. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Dave McKenna, Chair.
Thank you. Jeff and I has not met. We will meet this Thursday in these chambers at 1 o'clock, and I have one resolution around the interim financing for the airport project. Resolution I, document ID 8936. Resolution of the Tompkins County Legislature as elective legislative body of Tompkins County, New York, in accordance with Section 147F of the Internal Revenue Code of 1986, as amended. Approving the issuance by the County of Tompkins, New York, of a its airport bond anticipation notes 2020 Series A, subject to alternative minimum income tax, in an aggregate principal amount up to $10 million. And I so move.
Thank you, Dave. Take a breath. Seconded by Annie. Discussion? All right, we need 10 votes to pass this, and it needs to be a long roll call, full roll call.
Ooh. Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
That's unanimous. All set, Dave?
That's my report. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Government Operations Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
Government Operations met on December 5th. Most of what we have for you tonight is in our resolutions. Before I move Resolution F, which is policies, which we always like to talk about, I'll just remind everybody that the chair has announced a rather lengthy executive session. So let's keep that in mind in our discussions here. I'd like to move Resolution F, which is resolution to update the Administrative Policy Manual, Policy 02-43, Discrimination and Harassment Prevention, and Policy 10-22, Risk Management. This is ID 9062. I move it.
Second by Amanda. All right, Mike. So this is pulled by from consent. I know there were some changes. Deborah.
Well, can someone tell me who appoints the risk manager? By what process?
The risk manager is a position. It's a titled position.
It's a titled position.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, then I'm good with Henry's change.
Henry, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I propose to add a definition of risk manager to the to the policy, and also a change in policy section 2B, change provide to maintain. Following insurance provisions, coverages, I mean.
Okay, Kathy's saying that the definition of risk manager is actually the only change here.
Oh, it's the only change?
Everything else came out of committee, yes.
Okay. Well, it was highlighted.
Right.
Okay.
That would be friendly.
Okay. And friendly to the secretary. Okay. All right. So the idea is we're adding a definition of the risk manager into this policy. Rich, I saw with somebody else before Rich. Okay. Rich, Anna, Mike Sigler. Go ahead.
I would ask us to consider just a tweak in this to have the first line of the risk manager definition read responsible for coordinating management of threats posed to the county. So it's clear that risk management stays at the department head level, that they're responsible for risk management in their department.
It is not a department head position.
No, Jackie Kipple is our risk manager.
Right.
So it falls under the county administrator's office.
Right, but the actual consideration and identification should be happening at the department level.
Yeah. So I'm sorry, could you just restate your changes again?
Just saying responsible for coordinating management of threats posed.
It's fine. I don't think that's fine.
Don't worry with me.
Okay. Amanda? Okay. Coordinating management of threats. Okay, I just wanted to make clear it wasn't a department head. Yeah, okay. This Anna and then Mike?
This is just extremely minor, but on page 27, is this just a spelling issue or change of word? In G, first line of G, all contracts entered into by the county and bid documents let by, I think it's supposed to be led by.
Wait, your packet page 27? Is that what you said?
Yep.
Packet page 27, section G1, all contracts entered in by into by the county and bid documents. It currently says let by the county. I think it's meant to be led by the county.
It's let.
Let by the county?
Yes. Issued, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
That must be some form of legalese that doesn't quite
only
fit with my
people
brain.
Understand that, yeah. Yes, that's correct.
All right, then.
It is let, yeah.
I stand corrected.
Mike Sigler.
It's not really a question, more of a kind of observation, I guess. I mean, I'm looking at this. I'm going to vote yes on it for the simple fact that the committee decided to do this. But, I mean, I'm looking at this, and there are whole pages crossed out.
Now you're on the second one, right?
I'm on the risk management.
Risk management, okay.
So have we not gotten to this yet?
I mean, no, the one resolution is about both policies. So go ahead.
So I'm just looking at it. I'm just like, to be honest, I can't make, you know, heads nor tails of it. I don't really know what the new policy is going to be. Because I'm looking at this going, like, literally, there's like three pages that are just struck. And I'm like, well, were these three pages not important? Are we just decided? Are we moved those someplace else? That's, like I said, not really a complaint, more of a, I don't know. Like, I read this stuff a lot, and I can't get it. I'm thinking if somebody else from the public read this, they'd be like, I don't really know what's going on here. So just an observation.
Okay, Mike Lane.
Mike, I will personally request that a clean copy be given to the full legislature.
That'd be great. Thank you, Michael. Sorry about that. We can do that moving forward, too.
Yeah, I know it's a lot of paperwork, but I had that question. I started looking for the trades, and I gave up. Yeah. Okay. Anything else on either of these policies?
The only thing I would add is the last time it was updated was 1995. So there has been a lot of the procedures online aren't even the procedures we follow anymore. That's probably why there's so many strikes in some of these policies. Some of them are over 20, 25 years old.
So if someone gets over 25 years old, you just throw it away? Is that what you're saying?
No.
Thanks, Jason.
Welcome to my world.
I'm just saying a lot of things change, and I'm looking through some of the procedure now, and this is not how we handle some of those procedures.
I had a question that Lisa Holmes, the deputy county administrator who's doing most of these policies, about the contingency of if one of the four direct reports, if there's a complaint against one of the four. It's sort of a packet page 15 that talks about in the event that the commissioner of human resources is the subject of a complaint. So I wanted to know, so where is it spelled out about the county administrator, the attorney, the finance director, or the clerk of the legislature? And she said that's basically covered in the policy, that the human resources commissioner is responsible for the investigation and the follow-up. So she said that was understood in this, and I was fine with that. I don't think it needs to be spelled out any more than it is, but I just wanted to mention that I was asking about that. Is there any other discussion on these? Ready to vote? Resolution F. All in favor, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you, and thanks to GO for marching through all these policies.
Well, we have wonderful staff help.
Mm-hmm. All right, and you have two others?
Yes. J, appropriation from contingent fund, replacement pay, information technology services. That's ID 9000, and I move it.
Second by Leslie. Discussion? Short form roll call.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Are there any no's? That's unanimous. Thank you.
And Resolution K, amending the rules of the legislature, travel and training reimbursement. That's ID 9063. I so move.
Second by Amanda. Discussion. This one's a little different because this is amending our rules. It's not actually a policy in the policy manual. So, Mike.
I just want to say that, I really appreciate the work of the subcommittee of the GO group that was led by Rich John and had Amanda and Dan as members of that. They came forward with a suggestion here that we want to try to iron out the discrepancies between different conferences and the amount of money that might be available in our travel and training budgets for these kinds of things. So let's give this one a try.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks to the subcommittee. Anna?
I had one small change. On packet page 43, the third bullet down, just to make it a little less confusing, I'd like to remove the word developing so that it says information and or skills on trends or topics. Putting in the word developing, I think, got a little confusing.
I'm all right with that.
Okay, that's friendly.
We had, so under five, and I didn't know if this was something of interest to add, but it says an annual summary report of expenses incurred will be provided to the appropriate standing committee. And I wanted to potentially consider offering to have it say, in addition, stating who went to which conference and how much was spent. So that is it explicit.
Okay. Who went to which conferences?
Conferences and how much was spent, so that it is public record.
Okay. Is that friendly?
Yes.
Okay. Good.
A question, I guess this is for Kathy, is the note going to be on the final draft that is, okay. The one last thing that I wanted to bring up for myself, what I felt uncomfortable with, although I appreciate the intention of trying to get us to conserve money or try to be as frugal as possible, I would prefer to see that 100% at least be covered for each person, the equivalent of two NISAC conferences. And I mention that because for those of us who are on standing committees, those standing committees meet every 6 months. I think that would create a bit more equity and fairness for the fact that there is a wide variance of income levels between legislators, and it doesn't then make it inequitable for those who can less afford it. It also takes into consideration things like some people might want to share a room or be willing to share a room but have sleep apnea and can't, so they wouldn't have the ability to, or issues with mobility and needing a special car. And so there are a lot of ways in which people would like to be frugal but because of physical limitations cannot, and I wanted to make sure that was taken into consideration. I'm okay if this is something, if we pass this now and this is something that's revisited, but I would prefer if it were 100%, not 80%.
Rich.
I did want to mention the participation of the legislative clerks in helping with this policy. They answered a lot of questions for us. Also, I just wanted to alert the legislature that if we adopt this, we may also wish to consider a budget adjustment, that we have a current amount in our training budget that would probably not be sufficient to allow people to go to both NISAC conferences in the winter and then in the fall. So we may be looking at the math, just to give you a heads up on that. And that would probably address the issue, Anna, that you just raised.
So then that can happen subsequent to passing this tonight.
I would put out there that we did look at the numbers at the GO level, well, the subcommittee of the GO level, and we were talking about 80% of the full cost of going to both conferences less mileage because we didn't know how to address carpooling, which roughly would be $1,600 in each legislator's line.
Let me point out, that's not in the resolution. It's not in the policy. It's not in the suggested amendments.
We're getting ahead of ourselves. But
sure, but we're passing this with a certain understanding, and I have a concern, too. But go ahead.
Yeah, that's all. I just wanted to get that out there, that's what we had the discussion about.
Okay, Mike, and then Dan?
Yeah, Rich made the point that We're going to need some more money here. We've talked to Kathy Colbert and other folks here, and there will be either a contingent resolution to take some money out of contingency or some kind of a budget adjustment. We'll have to see. But, yes, that's on our radar to do.
Okay, so did GEO, as I said, there's nothing in, I don't see any dollar figure in the resolution, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so GEO talked about, but it's not proposed here.
We talked
any
about
80% or 100% or dollar amount, right?
We talked about $5,000 to get us through NYSAC 1. We may have to think about a bigger amount if we want to get us through NYSAC 2.
You mean that's the note at the bottom about a new contingent fund resolution. I'm just asking, clarifying that the policy as we vote on this does not include anything in the memo or the note.
That's correct.
Got it. Okay. Dan?
So just to clarify, the question was asked, is the note part of the record? It's not. Does that include the following two pages? They are not part of the record. So those are just doodlings
back,
to ourselves.
Back up in, yeah, just backup information.
Okay, that goes you. In, it's in the GEO minutes, right? Did it go into GEO's minutes?
I don't think the actual memo's in the minutes, but reference to it is.
I mean, we can ask to be have it included. On the other hand, again, it was, since the dollar amount is not really settled here, I'm not sure that is a great idea right now.
That's fine. I had no point behind it. I just want to clarify.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. So the understanding is we're going to certainly be entertaining a motion soon for contingent funding to support anybody who wants to go to NYSAC in January at the full coverage of about $1,000.
Or equivalent. Doesn't have to be NYSAC, but that's the
benchmark to make sure we have that, you know, immediately, because that conference is in 4 weeks. Okay. All right. Anything else on this? We need 10 votes because we're changing the rules of the ledge. All right. Ready to vote? All in favor, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you. Thanks to the subcommittee again.
Thank you, Rich, for all your work on it.
And is that anything else, Mike?
No, I'm done.
All right. Thank you so much. Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Can I ask a question about that, though, too?
No. Yes. What?
If it's a reimbursement and it's something that would improve your skill set, I would think that would be taxable income.
Okay, there's a whole other question.
Yeah.
I know that the committee has talked about with Rick Snyder at some length.
If it is, it is. If it's not,
no,
it's not.
No, that's for the benefit. If it's for the benefit of your employer, it's not income to you.
All right, Drew.
There are what's called qualified and unqualified reimbursements, and a qualified reimbursement's if you provide documentation or receipt that was actually expended out of your pocket, then the IRS does not treat that as taxable.
Okay. I figured I would just ask now because it's like right here. So.
Okay. All right. In general, I mean, often the payments will actually go through the county.
A lot of times, yes. Payments, you know, like rooms, that type of thing.
Right.
A lot of times. This might be mileage, might be meal reimbursement.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So PEAK report, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
So PEAK will be meeting tomorrow morning at 9:30. We will be taking up the issues that Dan raised at our last ledge meeting about the impact of the consolidation of the various natural resource funds into one fund and the impact that would have on future county funding for trails. We will be taking up a resolution drafted by Amanda Champion that will basically ban the county facilities and departments from buying single-use plastic instruments and, you know, plates and
supplies.
Stuff like that. And then we will be hearing from Barb Backstrom on her trip to the New York State Association of Recycling with lots of really good information. Barb sent us all a set of notes from that conference, and one of the things that was mentioned was that they're expecting a statewide ban on styrofoam to be in on the books in 2020, and sure enough, in the news today, we learned that that is coming from the governor, so that's great. These are all measures that are really necessary given the state of recycling and the secondary market for recycled materials. I mean, if stuff's not recycled, it ends up in landfill, and how much landfill can we accommodate, really? So that will be the exciting agenda for tomorrow's meeting, and we will have our January meeting on January 21st in the morning, again, because otherwise it would conflict with NYSAC.
Thank you, Deborah. Any questions? All right, thank you very much. Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
We will meet again on Friday at 9 a.m., and we will not be, we talked a little bit about whether we would do one or two of the direct report interviews at that time. We will not be doing it. We'll be pushed over till January. And I have one resolution.
Mike, are those going to be, is there going to be a general call for all of us to be invited to?
Absolutely.
Before they're scheduled?
Just like we did last time. Before they're scheduled, no, we're going to schedule it for the committee, and anybody else that wants to come will be invited.
I think the chair of the legislature needs to be solicited on that.
I think we already have
poll.
That happening.
I wasn't. All right. Okay. Obviously, it'll be a different chair next time, but there needs to be inclusion there.
I thought you were.
No. All right. You've got Resolution L?
Yes. Adoption of Local Law Number I of 2019, amending Chapter 133 of the County Code entitled Residency. That's ID 9015, and I so move.
Seconded by Glenn. Want to start, Mike?
Yeah, this was, I pulled this last meeting and brought it back today as promised. This is an issue that we have talked a lot about in Budget and Personnel Committee. It's what we're trying to do is, in rare circumstances, permit a waiver of residency. This is something that the county administrator has talked to us about. We've got a lot of department head searches going on. We want to make sure that, for example, some deputies may want to apply for the director positions, maybe living outside the county, and we don't want to necessarily exclude them from the process of the application. This would require a waiver for most positions. There's around 20 that are affected. Most of those waivers would be coming from the county administrator. There are a few that would be coming from the legislature as a whole if it was requested. In the event that the administrator wants to use this process of waiver, he would have to tell us that here at the legislature immediately upon his determination so that we could weigh in on it and object to it if we were not happy about it. Did I miss anything, Jason?
No, I think that captured this as a process that evolved through multiple pieces of feedback from its original state.
Okay, Shauna.
Thank you to the committee for reviewing this. I initially was against this resolution for the idea that I really believe in hiring local people to do local jobs. And then I had some conversations with my colleagues as well as Jason. And exactly what you were talking about, Mike, as far as people that are working their way up the ranks and are typically living outside of the county, they wouldn't have the opportunity for some of these department head jobs. And if we were to allow for people living outside of the county to apply, then they would be eligible. So I will be supporting this. However, I would like to make an amendment and add a resolved right after line 10 there. Resolved, a review of this changed county code will take place within 2 years and by December 31st, 2021.
I wouldn't that make sense between the two resolves that exist there, say line 14?
Yeah, we could do that.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. Is there a second? Is there a second? Second by Annie.
May I ask, is it just a general review, a specific review as to a certain statistics? What are we looking for?
I think it's just a general review to see how many waivers were issued and to see if it's actually working for us.
That would be friendly.
Is that friendly?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And do you have the language, Kathy?
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Amanda, did you have your hand up? Okay. Deborah?
Yeah, I would support Shauna's amendment because I know that we need to have this exception available to us, but I don't want it to become the rule rather than the exception. And the best way that we can monitor that is to just look at it again after a couple of years and see how it's working out.
Anna?
Yeah, I had a similar experience to Shauna at first. I was actually against this. For the reason that Shauna mentioned, which I've also researched, Jason and I spoke extensively about this. That was very helpful. The other reason for me was the environmental component of this, which is encouraging more and more people driving from longer distances or allowing for that, given the impact of transportation and gas on climate change and our own personal goals as a county. Well, it's personal, it's countywide personal. But Jason mentioned something very interesting that I want to share that changed my view on this, which is that it would be good for us to try and focus on incentive programs rather than punitive efforts. And it was a very impactful statement to prevent people from doing things just because of where they live isn't just or fair, but if we really believe in our environmental initiatives and climate change mitigation, then put our money where our mouth is. Maybe we do incentives like, providing support for our employees to get hybrid or electric cars, for example. Talk about telecommuting in departments. Those are incentives that I feel create a lot more flexibility, maybe increase morale of employees, and does create equity, I think, and still encourages looking locally as much as we can, but gives that flexibility. So thank you for pointing that out, and I would certainly like us to continue to focus on incentives rather than punitive initiatives.
Leslie, and then Dan.
So I did see your email, and I'm glad you all had wonderful conversations with Jason. This still troubles me. Thank you, Jason, at least for attempting to do something different than what originally came to us. It still troubles me, and I'll tell you why. First of all, I don't think encouraging people to live in Tompkins County is punitive. So that word bothers me. Secondly, there are lots of places in Tompkins County where we are pushing people out of the economic center of the county, the city, to go live because it is far more affordable to live out there. So it's not like there aren't places in Tompkins County that folks cannot live. Now, that said, I do understand the recruitment aspect of things, and when we recruit for any position, we recruit far and wide, especially our senior level staff. So if we are saying, for me, if we're saying to our most vulnerable and most marginalized populations of people that if you can't live in the city center, you can go to Groton, Newfield, or Danby, or other places, and you can afford to live there, and they are affording to live there, I don't quite understand why is it that we are saying that our department heads won't be able to live here as well, that it's really not affordable for folks to live here as well. And that's one of the arguments I heard. when we wanted to do this, that it's hard to get people to come here because, yeah, Tompkins County is an expensive place to live. So I am still not at a place where I feel that I can support this. That said, I have a question. Mike, in your presentation, and I'm sorry I wasn't at budget when we had the full discussion, in your presentation you talked about, you know, the county administrator makes that decision and then recommends to us and lets us know before an appointment is made. And if there's objections, gives us an opportunity to object. Well, what does that mean? If the legislature or the committee objects, does that mean it doesn't go through? Or we just object and that's it?
Since the administrator works for the county legislature, I would be hard-pressed to think of an example where if this legislature said, we don't want you to do that, that the county administrator would go full speed ahead. I think it has to do with the fact that we are the bosses and that we're asking the county administrator to inform us of what's going on very early in the process so that we can respond back before slope has happened that you're sliding down. So I guess that's the only way I can answer it.
I appreciate that. That actually answers it for me. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, Dan and then Amanda.
I'm going to vote against this. There's something about the department heads are going to make decisions or be big part of decisions that have impacts on the daily way of life in this county and financial implications for the people in this county, taxes. And the idea that they would not be subject to those same rules that they're helping to form and the same tax burden that they're helping to put onto others, it just bothers me a little. There's something disjointed about that. And similarly with the housing argument, yes, the housing is expensive in this county, but everybody in the county, by definition, has to figure out a way to afford their housing. And to say to this incoming department head, you don't need to do that, again, it just seems something wrong about that to me. These are well-paid jobs, department heads, and they, of all people, can find some kind of housing in this county. So I'll be voting against it.
Amanda? I really appreciate the discussion and everyone's different opinions, and I appreciate, Jason, your work on this, and I think I said in committee, make a very good case. I have a lot of concerns as well, but one thing I was going to ask, and I don't think it says it in here, can it specify that it's only, people can only live within contiguous counties? Like, so they're not commuting from Binghamton, but they could commute from Watkins Glen. You know, like, that's, sure. I don't know if that makes
sense. You bring up a good question. It was building off the existing waiver, or the existing residency exemption, which I'm just going to refer to it real quick to see if it talks about any county or only adjacent counties. I think it was any county. This was written for the, when it talked about the exemption or exclusion of assistant DAs, deputy sheriffs, and correction officers, or any county within New York State. So this would just be any county. I will say that probation officers, though, because that's a public officer's law, is only adjacent counties.
Right.
And I do think that the deputy sheriff exemption, which is also done through the public office law, is adjacent counties. But assistant DAs and COs, or correction officers, excuse me, are any county, to answer your question. So
yeah.
it would follow this, which is any county.
And if, I mean, that's not in the resolution. If that was something that I wanted to propose changing, does that need to, like, it's not really an amendment, like.
Well, it would. It could be done two ways. It could be done through changing the section of the law, which would be under Section 133.2-2, which would then impact assistant district attorneys and correction officers.
or it could be done as a probably a subsection 3 of section 133-3, specifically articulating an adjacent county or an adjacent county. I would say any change like that would require this to probably go through the public hearing process.
Gotcha. Okay.
I'll speak just from a practical matter.
Yeah.
I will say of the when we did a survey of the 33% of the employees that currently live out of county, I want to say more than 85% of those are either Schuyler or Cortland County, and I want to say probably nearly all, with the exception of a handful, are not adjacent counties, just because of the practicality of where they're driving from.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to weigh in. I doesn't Scott Vanderpool live in Syracuse?
Yeah.
The TCAT manager lives in Syracuse.
Yeah.
Our workforce development director lives in Geneva for another month.
Our INHS director.
Ithaca Neighborhood Housing director just moved to Schuyler County because she couldn't afford the housing. For me, it's not so much that somebody can't afford to move into Tompkins County. It's that somebody from a nearby county, from the modern American point of view, commuting time, which much of our country, people commute for an hour each way. Many folks would consider a job in Tompkins County but would not want to uproot their families. So it's not a matter that so much that they couldn't afford to live here, but that they may have a similar position in a nearby county. Remember, these department head positions are very specialized. They're yes, in some cases you've got people coming up through a department, a larger department like DSS, where the last several commissioners have come from within our department, but there are a lot of other positions where you really don't have that kind of path. You don't have a big enough department even to have people to come up. So these are very specialized positions, though almost every county has basically the same suite of people that we have, and those folks might be exceedingly qualified, might be exactly the right people that we would want. But they have kids in the schools, or they have a partner or a spouse who's got a job in the other community. And so for me, this is a matter of looking for excellent people to lead our important departments. And, you know, if you think Scott Vanderpool's doing a good job, then I don't.
He's not a department head.
I understand.
He's equivalent.
That's a distinction without a difference for me. So I feel like we can. Yeah, I would love to have.
The distinction is we don't employ him.
I would love to have everybody. You know, when I heard he lived in Syracuse, I thought, oh, he's going to stay there?
Since you brought him up personally, he does have an apartment in Ithaca as well.
Okay. I don't want to make it personal about a particular person.
Yeah, let's not have personalities
right
here.
But I'm just saying it just occurred to me that's an example, and I think he's doing a great job. So I am going to support this. I think the idea of a two-year look back is a great fail-safe. The idea of a notification and communication to the full legislature before an offer is made is another important fail-safe. And I think that this deserves a try. And the county administrator has asked for this, and I think it's something that a tool that will be important as we build our staff. Are there any other discussion? Okay, Henry, then Annie.
Jason, do any of the neighboring counties have the same policy?
Our neighboring counties do not have this exact one. There is three counties that I'm aware of that provide exemptions or waivers for all public officers. Westchester County exempts all public officers from living in the county. That's through public officers law. I want to say Tioga does as well. And I think Schenectady provides a waiver process. There may be more. There isn't an easy way to find that out, only because One of the discussions about residency and public officers law is because there have been so many exceptions made at the state level through home rule legislation, the generalization of the law is no longer applicable. So you're starting to see a lot of local laws exempt or modify the residency requirement, which is what the county did with correction officers and assistant district attorneys. The reason I say that is if it was only done through public officers law, I could easily pull the law down and look at the 150 that have been done, which I have, but to be able to query other counties is a little bit more difficult without talking to every county, looking at every county code. We did not do that, but the samples and some of the examples, the way I crafted the waiver was based off of other cities and counties that have done this.
How many times since you've been hired as county administrator would you have used this policy?
I can't tell you. I can't answer that question. What I can say is we have lost finalists in department-head searches due to explaining to them that they would have to move into the county, and therefore they withdrew from the process. So they were folks that would have gone to the finalist stage to be interviewed, but they have withdrawn from the process because they knew there was no alternative other than to move into the county. Whether or not they would have been offered the position, I can't answer that question.
And doesn't our posting for these positions generally say must be a resident within 6 months or something, right?
It does. It does. And it's not uncommon that people will still apply and then ask the question. And when we get to that, you know, to be considered, and if they're considered, then they'll address that issue. So I can't answer the question of how many times it would have been used, but I can tell we've lost two candidates as a result.
But it's like ban the box. It's in front in the application. We don't know who hasn't applied because they saw that in the original posting.
That's possible as well, yeah.
But is that the end of
you? Right. So, okay, for now.
Okay. I think, Annie, you're next, and then Shauna.
Yes, thank you. So I did second Shauna's amendment, which I do like as far as the look back in 2 years. And it's going to be when I'm still here, hopefully. And because I'm very, very hesitant about this, trying to keep the diversity, working on the diversity and inclusion committee, trying to keep as much diversity or increase the diversity in the people that serve the people in the county is very important to me, and so I just question of how hard that's going to be, and if we're opening these positions up a little more broader. And I also second what Leslin said about as far as there are places in the county that are more affordable and than others. And one of the reasons that we might be paying more taxes here than some other counties is because we have a lot of good services, and we're asking people to come in and help us administer those services. But they don't live here, and they don't know what it takes to survive and thrive in this county. So I'm very concerned about that. I mean, if you just talked about, you know, specific examples about somebody working their way up through the department and that they don't live in the county and we want to make an exception for that person, I would be more inclined to support just that. So I would like to see, you know, if this passes tonight, I would definitely want to see in 2 years that we're doing other things. Are we doing other things to encourage or support people moving into the county to have electric vehicles, to address the environmental issue? Are we doing other things to help train and educate people or give them the experience so that they are, I mean, I know not everybody would be able to take that position, but to help people that are already here working for the county. So I just want to make sure we're doing everything or quite a few other, I won't say everything, but quite a few other things besides just this of opening it up.
Okay, Shauna?
I just had a question about the waiver. Would anyone that applies outside of the county be granted that waiver, or would there have to be an exception or a reason for them wanting the waiver?
You know, the waiver, the way it's set up is that the residency requirement is still a requirement. I mean, the waiver has to be obtained, it has to be granted, and if it's not granted, it's still going to be a requirement. So it's not as if they're exempt from the residency requirement. It's still going to be advertised as, you know, residency requirement still exists. So it has to be granted in order for the residency to be waived.
Okay. So I guess the question for you is, if someone came to you and said, I just can't afford to live in Tompkins County, versus someone that said, I have a student or I have a kid and they really love their school, like, how would you weigh those two different priorities?
I can't answer that question. It's a tough question to answer. It depends on the circumstances.
Rich?
I will support the resolution. I think we've certainly given Jason a lot of input, and I think we can trust that he's heard it and will consult with us in any instance where this comes up. And I certainly understand the impetus to try to get the best people possible working for us.
Henry.
Jason, what have we been doing about succession planning in terms of, you know, the head department heads?
Well, I mean, this brings up a good point about succession planning, because I think right now we have about 8 deputies that don't live in Tompkins County. So from that perspective, and I don't remember all of them in all their positions, but if they wanted to succeed into a director position or department head position, without this, they would have one of two options: either not consider the position, or they would have to move into the community, into the county. So to a certain extent, this can assist for folks that are either current deputies and they don't live in the county and they want to pursue that department head position to allow them to obtain that, or at least be considered for it. It also allows, you know, as I said, we have 30%, 31% of the workforce now that doesn't live in the county, and their opportunity to advance could be limited, and this provides that opportunity to open up. From a succession planning perspective, I will say, first and foremost, I think our ultimate goal is always to try to develop the leaders within the organization to have them advance. And where there are, you know, that's usually the case the majority of the time. The only time it's not is when there's a reason that substantial change is looked at, or there isn't the development of those leaders in the organization to do that. So from a succession planning perspective, almost all, if not now, I think all of your departments, including workforce development, now has a deputy position. So there is the ability for folks to advance in the organization, take on higher leadership responsibilities, and be groomed, or be, you know, have the development opportunities to grow as a leader, then ultimately fill the leadership roles. That's a key piece to it. You know, we're getting a little bit outside the scope of this, but you've budgeted now for 3 years in a row a substantial training budget, the HR budget, to allow folks for additional training opportunities. And I know as we go into next year, we're looking at creating more, and we have this year, we're going to expand upon it, more of a centralized leadership development function and training in the organization as a whole. That contributes to succession. I don't know if I'm hitting on what you want to talk about exactly, but you know, that's a little outside the scope of the residency piece. But
you said 8 deputies?
Yeah. 7 or 8, I believe.
Yes.
Live out of the county.
Yes.
So really, this law would apply to those eight or seven deputies who want to rise up.
They could.
And it could rise up, and knew that when they were hired.
Absolutely.
That there was a residency requirement. And the people who live about an hour and a half away, who work for other counties, probably.
Could. I mean, to be honest with you, the easiest issue of residency is if you have someone coming from out of state, or from very, you know, someone who can't commute to here as an opportunity, meaning they're coming from, you know, you look to hire someone from out of state, well, residency waiver wouldn't necessarily apply to that in that situation, because they're going to have to move anyways. It's not as relevant of an issue than someone who lives in Cortland County, say, because their spouse works in Syracuse and they work, you know, in this direction, or so on and so forth.
And when you advertise for jobs, are most of your jobs advertised nationally?
Department head positions?
Department head positions?
Yes. I would say yes, and probably even some deputies. An example where it's not was the probation director, because we had a civil service list.
But human rights officer, you did, in fact, advertise nationally.
Did.
Okay.
Leslie, was your hand up?
My hand was up because Jason said something quite interesting a moment ago. And I keep reading this thing over and over again, that the
residency requirement, you said, Jason, will still be active. Somehow that's not what I'm reading in here. I'm not sure there's any place in here where I'm reading that.
So the waiver may be granted. So in the absence of a granted waiver, the residency requirement applies. The residency requirement applies because it's subject to the public officer's law.
Right.
So absence of an exemption, the residency requirement applies. And absence of a waiver granted, the residency requirement applies. So the residency is covered under the public officer's law, I guess is my point. The waiver is what you're inserting from a local law perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help explain it?
It does.
Okay.
Thank you, Leslie. I had that question myself. So is it, you said in the posting, it is, these positions do say residency is required.
Yes.
I thought the whole point was.
It does. As we move forward, we have to figure out how we're going to frame the advertisement, to be honest with you. I mean, I think our goal is to obtain residency, but in certain instances where you have a lack of applicants, a waiver should be entertained.
Right, but the issue about the gatekeeping, I mean, would the posting say residency required, but a waiver may be requested? I mean...
We haven't worked out the exact language,
okay.
But you know, it has to be identified. I mean, the whole purpose of this is to allow for a waiver should you have a lack of applicants or lack of qualified applicants.
Right, but also to avoid the barrier,
yes,
that keeps people from applying. Okay, Anna?
I just, one of the things that you said that I appreciated, and what I'm hearing is the sentiment isn't to, like, create a skewed where people who live outside the county now have a greater advantage. I mean, our intention is still to prioritize, and our ideal is that everybody would live in the county. And I appreciate that you've said that, and I just want to reiterate that. That's what I'm hearing.
Yes.
My concern, and I've heard this several times, and it continues to raise concern for me, is the comment, well, anybody who took a job here knew what they were getting themselves into, so they should have prepared, is the sort of sentiment. Because it's listed, you brought up a really important case, which is, and I know someone who's in a situation where their husband works in Syracuse and they work in Ithaca, and they intentionally live in Cortland because they have to. Their partner can't get a job in Ithaca. If their partner could, then they would, but they also need to be a two-family household. So to say to that person, well, you can't rise up in the organization no matter how good a job you're doing because you knew it was a, you know, residency requirement, so it's your fault because you knew when you applied for a job in the department. It starts to resonate a little funny to me. I appreciate that our intention is still to prioritize the county. But it creates that small flexibility for those exception cases, and they have to seek a waiver. And that, to me, is sufficient.
I want to make... Deborah, did your hand up?
I just wanted to call the question.
Okay, before you do, I was going to say... I think that there's... look, I think we acknowledge that our staff is not as diverse as we would like. In some cases, I mean, there are real trade-offs. Do you want to seek diversity, which may mean really recruiting from around, from broader, or do you want to support people going on a career ladder, which may mean kind of locking in the level of diversity that we have now? So there are real trade-offs. I acknowledge this is a complex issue. There's probably no one exact answer, and I think that's why looking back after 2 years is really going to be the right thing. Anything new to say? Anything new to ask? Henry, did you have your hand up?
Nope.
No. Should we go and vote?
Yes.
Okay. Bless you. All in favor with the amendment of the 2-year look back. All in favor of Resolution L. Opposed? 5. Somebody not here? I had 8 to 5. Should be 6.
Did you vote?
Yeah. Let's try this again. All in favor, please raise your hands.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Opposed?
No,
I didn't see Dave. I'm sorry. I didn't see Dave. Okay, 9 to 5. That passes. All right. Thank you all very much. Okay. Mike, did you have anything else for your report?
I do not.
All right. Any other questions for Mike? All right. Thank you. Let us take a 5-10 minute break, I guess. 10 minute break so you can refill your plates. And we'll call recess and then we'll come back. Thank you. I'd like to call us back to order. I know you don't want to come back to order. Glenn, Anna, Rich, Mike, Dan, David. All right, Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee. Leslie McPean Claiborne, Chair.
Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee met on December 9th. One of the things, we had a presentation, just a follow-up from Kit. Martha, you mentioned in your remarks earlier tonight about the study we did with the aid of students from Cornell relative to civil service and our attempt to convince the state to allow us to pilot a pass-fail system. Like Martha said, they weren't biting. One of the other things that we had proposed around about the same time through the Workforce Diversity Committee was to take a look at a work-from-home sort of policy. And we piloted that. The Department of Social Services agreed to be a pilot for that proposal. And they did. And Kit was able to give us a very comprehensive report back on how it has been working within that department. We wanted to take a look at it. There are lots of pieces to it, and not everybody gets to do it. There are applications, ways for people to report back in, making sure that IT services are available to folks so they can work on their computers at home. Although you're working from home, being work ready in the event that you have to come in because something is going on. We chose, we didn't choose, but the Department of Social Services seemed like the ideal candidate for piloting this because of the complexity of their work. So many moving parts. So that's one of the things that happened, and we got a really wonderful presentation from Kit on how it has been working within that department. And now it's a matter of we left it in the hands of administration and HR to continue to take a look at it and see if it's something we want to try with another department that's not as complex before we decide if it's something we will roll out county-wide and have some policy around that. So that was wonderful to see something actually in action. A little bit of discussion about very small our diversity and inclusion award. Since I've been on this legislature, this body handed out one such award, and we'd like to sort of revive that. So it is in the hands of HR and administration again to move forward. The Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee did have a write-up on what it would look like from soup to nuts, basically, from application or nomination all the way to an award being given and the honor being recognized in some way, shape, or form. And so they'll take a look at it and hopefully come back to us with a more polished version of the draft that we presented to them that we can move forward with it. Amy did bring, share with us a draft recruitment document for Chief Equity and Diversity Officer, the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee is interested in having some input in sharing about information around what we're looking for in an ideal candidate. What are the attributes? What are the expectations of an ideal candidate that can help populate that recruitment document? And so we all have homework to look at what was given to us and, you know, add some input. There was some that was already given at the committee. We're going to give more so that HR and admin can move forward with posting and recruitment, and we're not wasting time getting the best candidate on board. Marcia has been working with us in updating our marketing materials for the county. That includes the WDIC magnet. That includes some work on our webpage so people can easily check and see what we've been up to. And we can present ourselves as a county that is very welcoming to all. So we need to have our webpage continuously sort of updated and looked at, et cetera. We also talked a little bit about another thing that we left in the hands of administration a few months ago, maybe a year ago, a while ago, and that is trying to figure out a way that we, both the committee as well as all of this this entire body, can hear from department heads, whatever shape that takes. So how can we know what people are doing, what are the actions they're taking within their departments to sort of foster and continue the movement towards diversity and inclusion? May not be us hearing directly from them. They might be reporting to county administration, and then we have some synthesize or some synopsis of what people have been doing as reported from county admin. We don't know, but we've put that back because we'd like to know what is happening. We have our climate survey. We get information from there, but we're really curious about on the day-to-day level, what are people doing? And is it diversity and inclusion continues to be at the forefront of actions, that, not forefront, but embedded in everything that folks are doing? I think that was sort of the bulk of it. We are going to meet again for our subcommittee on LGBTQ plus and law enforcement policy. We continue to do work on that. Our Sheriff's Department has been very, very involved and good about it. So just looking at now policy level, there's policy within the jail that they have in their operations plan, but countywide, looking at where do we go next. So on December 23rd, that Monday, 11 a.m., the subcommittee will be meeting again, and hopefully we'll have something much more concrete to bring forward. If there are other members of the committee who think of other things that we talked about, please chime in. Chime in.
Thank you, Leslie. Anybody else? Leslie, I wasn't able to listen into the report that Kit gave about work from home. Did it include any measure of, you know, estimate of satisfaction, employee satisfaction with the process?
Yes. It was a pretty comprehensive report, and most people who have been using it, the satisfaction rate is high. Kit mentioned that one of the things that they noticed, even in their hiring, I can't remember at what level, might be at the interview process, one of the questions that get asked of them, they don't even mention this, is people asking, are there opportunities to be able to work from home? And it's not a replacement for childcare. It's not any of that. It really is just providing a different space for people, like there's a snow day coming, you know. County isn't going to close. People live in the outskirts. You know, here's an opportunity for that. But for the most part, people requesting to work from home have to do it in advance. There's a vetting process. There's a number of things that go with it. So, and
thank you, Annie.
Yes, and it was really interesting to learn things that I wouldn't have thought of. That there were quite a few people that had tried it to work from home for, say, a couple of days a week, and that didn't like it, felt that they, for whatever reason, they wanted to work at DSS, but they at least they got the opportunity to do that and to try that out. So that was good to hear, and it was interesting to hear that, too, that people, you know, like as Leslie said, they're ready. So rather than you think, you know, for me, I would think, you know, getting up and putting your pajama or putting your bathrobe on or, you know, and sitting there in your bathrobe all day and, you know, working when you want to work. But it's more about, you know, you get to your computer at whatever, 8 or 9, and you're checking in, telling your supervisor, I'm here for duty, and then you can get calls. And you are ready to come in if they need you, because I was thinking too, oh, well, if if you lived out in the country and you had one car, then you wouldn't have to go into work, but they have to be ready to come in if they need to. It doesn't happen a lot, but they need to be ready to be able to do that. So I thought that was quite interesting, and they sound like they had a really good satisfaction level from the program.
You might think about having Kit just do a presentation for this body, because I found it really fascinating.
Okay. Great. I like that idea. Dan?
It is really interesting. I had a couple of questions that popped to mind. I wonder if you know. Was it people were doing it like once a week on average, or was it that kind of schedule? Or?
I'm sorry.
She said a maximum of 2, except with a few exceptions who very occasionally did 3, but it was most common was 1.
1 or 2. Okay.
1 was the most common.
And then how long did the trial period go on for?
This week.
5 years.
Go ahead.
5 years.
Right? Yes.
5 years.
5 years.
Get some good data.
It was a slow start.
Okay.
You know, so, I mean, basically they've been solidly doing this for probably about 3 years.
Okay.
To see how it works. And there was some transition at DSS as well. There's a lot that happened in that time frame.
Yeah. I mean, this started being talked about when Patricia was here before Kit. And you know, yeah. It took a little bit.
And how do I apply?
Apply for a job at DSS. Talk to the county administrator. They might be hiring.
Do I have to move to the county?
Then you apply.
There's tests.
Lots of paperwork.
There's lots of tests online.
I would just add.
Well, it was. It really was an interesting presentation to see how people have reacted, how it's worked for some, not others, and how it's benefited the department. The level of production for some folks who this worked for better than if they were sitting at the desk with all the distractions of the day, people being able to, it really was interesting to hear about it. So, might be worth it to have you all take a full look at it.
That's great. Anna, did you have some?
Yeah, just wanted to note what was really interesting is that the resistance and why it took a couple of years to transition in was they had to do some training and education with the managers. It was more with the management because it's a transition and it's scary if you're trying to manage people and they're not that physically there. So it took some mental shifting and culture shifting. So that's why it took a little bit of a transition.
And are they still doing it?
Yes.
Okay. And offering it if new people want to sign it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Anything else for Leslie? Thanks very much. I appreciate hearing that, more about that. Thanks very much. Housing and Economic Development Committee, Anna Kellis, Chair.
We did meet on December 10th. We had a very lengthy conversation. Over the last couple months, I've been putting together a document in collaboration with departments and agencies that we work with that provide housing services. And the document that was put in the packet that anybody can see is an outline of all the work that the county does with respect to housing split into the categories of housing development and then housing services. And the reason that I wanted to do that is because our housing services and housing support is sort of disparate and spread across many different or multiple committees and like 15, 20 different agencies and departments. Because we don't have land use authority, it can be really difficult to get a grasp of what it is that we actually do and what role we play. The intention was to first identify what role we play and then whether or not there are gaps in what we're providing. So it was an identity, not an identity crisis, but an identity evaluation of who we are in that context. We delved into the housing development component. The intention is to dive into the housing services component in this next month meeting. And all of the agency directors and department heads that provide housing services have been invited to that meeting, so it will be a rather large meeting, and I certainly invite all of you to attend. Hopefully it'll be quite dynamic. The other presentation that we had was the 2020 plan for TCAD, and I thought she did an excellent job. I think the sort of general theme, sentiment, feedback that was given by committee members, it was an interest to dive more and to elaborate more on workforce development in their 2020 plan. If anybody from the committee has any other thoughts, but that seemed to be the general sentiment that it was good. We appreciate it. They've done a ton of work. And they also presented on the updated county workforce development strategy. And that report is out. I think that is actually online on the TCAD website at this point. That was the last workforce development strategy that Martha Armstrong will be developing for the county, as she has officially announced her retirement and actually has left TCAD at this point and is in the Galapagos, which I am very, very jealous.
She's coming back.
She is.
For the party.
She is coming back for the party on Thursday, and maybe if there wasn't a party, she might not come back. It's quite beautiful there. So we had that. I do want to note that the January meeting is on January 23rd at 10:30. It's typically at 9:30, but we've moved it to 10:30 because at 8:30, the IORA will be having their monthly meeting, and I wanted to give the opportunity for everybody who cares about housing to attend that, because they will be announcing whether or not there will be an inclusion into the Green Street development of a conference center. That decision will be made at that meeting. And depending on whether or not they select the option of having a conference center, will determine how many units of housing will be in that development. If there's a conference center, it'll be 208 units. If not, I think the preferred development that they have selected or design they've selected will have 273 units, and I will note that those will all be, they're slated to all be affordable housing units in an arena that is full of market rate and luxury housing that is going to be a huge boon for the city. The last thing I will mention is Duxon brought up the ordinance, the accessory dwelling unit ordinance that the city is currently reviewing. It did get extended or tabled until next month, and I just wanted to note that their PEDC meeting on which that will be discussed was moved where it would typically be the 8th or the 2nd Wednesday of the month, because the first Wednesday of the month is New Year's Day. It has been moved to January 22nd, Wednesday, January 22nd, and that is at 6 p.m. if anybody wants to attend that. And that's my report.
Thank you, Anna. Amanda?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you could tell us where TCAD stands with hiring their workforce person that we talked about a year ago?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. My understanding is they're Their job description is now complete. I think they have posted it. As far as I understand, they have posted it. And they're in the process. So early in the beginning of next year, that person should start. So one of the things that she did talk about, because that was brought up and a bunch of us were a bit concerned that it has been delayed, that she has had, she hired one staff person to fill one position, reorganized the staffing, and had another retirement, and then they were finishing their five-year fundraising campaign. So those things took a bit of precedence. I was glad that she was able to walk through that. We did express that it was still a concern and that we were enthusiastic that that would be her priority next. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for asking.
Okay, anything else for Anna? All right, since we're talking about parties, I forgot to mention earlier that tomorrow at 3 o'clock, am I right, Rich, we're celebrating...
it was 4 o'clock.
No, it's been moved to 3. I'm glad I'm mentioning it.
Okay.
We're celebrating the naming of the Joe Mariana Conference Room in the Tompkins Center for History and Culture. Moved to 3 because of the 4 o'clock meeting about the forestry plan. So... you got your day filled, you know. Calendar is full tomorrow, 3 o'clock at the Tompkins Center for History and Culture. All right. Thank you, Complete Census Count Committee. Mike Lane, Chair.
We got snowed out last time. Our next meeting is going to be on January 6th at 9 a.m. here in this legislature chambers. Two things I wanted to tell you about. One is that we've had a lot of interest from different groups, including a lot of interest in helping us from the League of Women Voters and from Tompkins Community Action, both that can get to help us get the word out. Community Action, particularly some of the hard-to-count individuals, will be part of that. The other thing I wanted to tell you about is that the governor announced money for census complete count outreach. There are grants for all counties. Based on a number of factors, Tompkins was eligible for about $137,000 in grant funding. The catch was we had to have a proposed budget of what we were going to do with our money in by last Friday the 13th, naturally.
When did they tell you about this?
A week or so, or maybe 2 weeks ahead of that?
Yeah.
And I really want to thank administration, Jason, Amy Hendricks, Nick Murphy, Marsha Lynch, then Greg Potter, and I'm sure I've missed some people, but they really went together and did a memo and a budget, bringing forth things that we would do with the census money if we were able to snag that grant. And the budget, it came to a total of $139,450. So apparently we have until the end of December to refine this. I see Amy shaking her head, yes. But we got it in on time, and I really want to thank that group for extra effort to get that done.
Amazing that it was so close to the amount of the grant.
Well, we'll see how much they give us.
Do we need to refine it to exactly the amount of the grant, or is it better to leave it a little off?
I think it is.
Amy, you want to speak to that?
I should add, Amy and Nick and Marcia really did the brunt of the work. I think I just signed the memo.
Did you read the memo?
I did read the memo. Who's gonna supervise this? That was the question I had. But
that's when we assigned Nick.
Nick got the job. Yeah.
So they will. They've received it. They'll let us know what revisions they want to see in it. But it's due by December 30th. So I'm assuming that if we hear anything, it'll be next week, right in the midst, and we'll have 2 weeks to turn it around.
Thank you for the best question of the year, Amy. Anything else, Mike?
No.
Any questions for Mike? Deborah?
Not a question, but just a comment. I read my hometown newspaper, the Buffalo News, and there was an article in there the last couple of days about how Erie County is really panicking. They're certain that they're going to be severely undercounted, and they don't know what to do about it. But they feel like they're not going to be able to figure out how severe the problem is until after the census is finished. So I think we're probably better off than Erie County.
The folks from the Census Bureau tell us we're a little ahead of the curve on most of this compared to the other counties in the region. I don't know about Buffalo. In Erie, I should say.
I know I read online that 24 states are spending no money on the census.
Well, like Florida, I assume.
Right. But there was a contrast between the states that were spending money and the states that were not. And 24 were not spending a dime.
Amazing.
What was the pattern?
I think it was a pattern.
There wasn't a pattern? Okay. Okay. Anything else for Mike? Thanks, Mike. Downtown Facilities Committee, Glenn Morey, Chair.
Thank you. We did not meet in December. And closing date is still scheduled for the end of this month. And there's been a request that we meet on the 3rd instead of the 9th to discuss one issue, and that's parking. We have to close off the parking lot because it becomes our liability now. So it'll be January 3rd on 4 o'clock.
January 3rd at 4. Thank you, Glenn. Any questions? Annie?
I think that will now be the only meeting I'm missing. I'll be away from the December 27th through the 6th of January.
Have a good time. All right. Anything else, Glenn?
No.
Thank you very much. Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
Thank you, Martha. The Public Safety Committee has not met since our last legislative meeting. We will be meeting this Thursday, the 19th, at 3:30 here in Chambers. The one item I'd like to mention is that we will be receiving a report from Dave Sanders, our criminal justice coordinator, summarizing where we stand with a prodigious amount of data on trends with our jail population, with crime in the county, and I am hopeful that this will lead to a good discussion at the committee level on the start of considering priorities for 2020. There's certainly things we should be talking about to make sure we maintain the very good work we've done, and also to build on it. There's, in looking at the various trend lines in the data, there's some issues that either are going to come at us or we haven't really seen the improvement that we've seen generally. There's some lagging areas, and so I'm hopeful that we will have a really good discussion. I'd invite all the legislators to attend if they're interested.
Thank you, Rich. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much. The next item is a member filed resolution, but we have an executive session. But first, if we could switch things a little and take the minutes of the December 3rd meeting. Moved by Anna, second by Deborah. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the minutes of December 3rd, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous. All right. I would like to ask for a motion to go into executive session for a number of topics, and we will, after executive session, come out and take one item of business. The topics are personnel about a specific individual, to receive legal advice, labor negotiations, and real estate. Moved by Anna, second by Deborah. All in favor, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Let us take a 5-minute break to break down the cameras, to call Jonathan Wood on the phone, and we will be back. One more piece of business to do. Resolution M, filed by Mike Sigler. Can I have everybody sit down, please? Amanda, would you let people know in the back that we're in? Mike Sigler?
Yes, resolution. Let's see what I did with it.
Back at page 49.
Appointment of Election Commissioner for 2020 to 2021, submitted by Legislator Ziegler. Whereas Republican Election Commissioner Elizabeth W. Cree's term is due to expire December 31st, 2019, and whereas state law permits if no certificate has been filed to appoint a Commissioner of Elections, the Republican members of the Tompkins County Legislature may vote on the appointment of the Tompkins County Republican Commissioner to a two-year term. Now, therefore, be it resolved that Elizabeth W. Cree be and hereby is appointed Republican Party Elections Commissioner for the two-year term commencing in January 1st, 2020 and ending December 31st, 2021. And I move that.
ID 9085. Is there a second? Second by Dave. Discussion. All right. I have been informed that I understand that state law, as the second whereas, identifies that this is an unusual situation, that the certificate has not been filed, was not filed 30 days before the end of her current term, which would have been December 1st. So in this case, the Republican members of the legislature may vote, and it is just up to the Republican members here to vote, and it is not a vote including the entire legislature. So are there any questions on that? All right, you ready to vote? All in favor of Resolution M. That is 3 in favor, 0 opposed. That passes. All right, if there's no other business, Mike Lane?
Move to adjourn.
Henry seconds. Everybody have a great holiday. See you tomorrow at the Joe Mariana thing, and have a great holiday, folks. We are adjourned.